Okay, I think we're recording.
Well, I think we ought to have a preliminary discussion first.
Oh, do you? Okay. Oh, sure. There we go. Okay, it's running now, Jim. Okay. Well, interviewing Jim Hoy, and Jim was a lobbyist beginning in the 1945 legislative session and a legislator in the 1960s. Is that correct?
Correct.
And an attorney, and I'm interviewing him at his home here in Billings, Montana. And Jim, maybe you could just kind of basically describe the legislature when you first came to Helena in 1945, maybe some of your thoughts and impressions, and perhaps how it changed over the time that you experienced it.
Well, of course, it changed radically, but when I came in 1945, I came to assist Bill Jameson.
Who became the federal judge.
Yes, he was a partner in our law firm, later federal judge, and a wonderful, brilliant man, full of great ideas, and he was absolute 100% integrity.
Now, was Bill Jameson a lobbyist?
He was.
For who?
And for the railroads to begin with.
I see, okay.
And I was assisting him.
I see.
In 1945. I had just come with the law firm, it's called Crowley, or Coleman Jameson and Lamy at that time. And so I went up to Helena to assist Bill Jameson, who was the lobbyist. And a highly respected man.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a difference in those days from today, when people denigrate lobbyists.
Yeah.
But then they were respected.
Yeah.
Yes, they deserved to be anyway.
Well, sure, yeah.
And so we were both, I think, thought of rather highly. I certainly Bill Jameson was. Well, that's all changed now.
Yeah.
Because the do-gooders have taken over, and I don't think they've made things much better.
Jim, what was the key? How would you describe Bill Jameson, and how was he what was the key to his success as a lobbyist and a lawyer?
Well, two things: his intellect and his integrity, and his experience in the practice of law.
Did you get to know Governor Bonner in that period?
I knew,
maybe even, I guess, when you were first there, the governor would have been Sam Ford.
Yes.
Did you ever meet him?
I did. Oh, yes, I knew Sam.
How would you describe him?
Or I should kind of say, I wouldn't have called him Sam, I'd call him Governor. Well, I don't have a very good recollection in the way I can describe briefly what he was like, but he was a man of integrity and highly respected.
Once I had a visit with Everett Shuey,
yes,
who later lobbied for the wool growers and for Montana Power Company.
Yeah.
And he said when he was a young man, he had an opportunity to speak, I think, to the state wool growers banquet or something. And he said he had the bad luck to speak right after Governor Ford. And he said Governor Ford was a gifted public speaker. That's how he described him. And a very, very persuasive and effective public speaker. And he said, so for a young fellow like me to speak after Governor Ford was a pretty daunting thing to have to do. That was his recollection of Ford. I met Ford's widow, Mary Ford, one time, and had a nice conversation with her. And she, I believe Ted James was their son-in-law. Ted James, who was the lieutenant governor. But I'm just interested, you know, to be able to visit with someone who'd actually met Governor Ford and would have some impression of him. Do you have any impression of him, I mean, other than?
Well, not really. I think he was, as I am, I think he was from Kansas, the University of Kansas, and Bottomley, judge up in the north part of the state, was also
okay.
From
there was a Bottomley who became Attorney General, I
yes,
think, wasn't there?
He
yet?
Was.
Yeah. Then you also mentioned that you knew Governor Bonner a little bit too?
Yes, a little bit. He was, I think he had defeated Art Lamy for a nomination, Democratic nomination.
Oh.
For governor.
I see, and then went on to beat Ford.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he was supported I'm sure, by the Anaconda Company, but the story out was that the Anaconda was supporting Art Leamy. And so everybody that didn't like the company, they voted for the bird that was supported by the company.
And so you would have had the impression probably that that Ford was independent of the Anaconda Company?
Well, I think so.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a common misunderstanding, perhaps in history, that the Republicans were close to the big dominating corporate interests in Montana, and the Democrats were generally the crusading populace that were against them. And I think there were a fair number of Republicans that were...
That's a concept.
That's
a
concept.
That's true.
But I was going to ask you about that. Well, what is your impression of that?
Well, I think it was wrong. Now, the Anaconda lobbyists, they were... one of them, I think, is Wilkinson.
Al Wilkinson?
Pardon?
Al Wilkinson?
Al Wilkinson. Very talented, persuasive, and likable guy. Boo McGilra.
Yes.
Those are two that I remember especially.
Yeah.
And there were something devious about their operations, too, I'll have to say that.
How do you think? How did they operate?
Well, they operated.
They operated differently than Bill Jameson?
Oh, yes. He was the soul of integrity, and Al Wilkinson wasn't, you know. They were out to do what was necessary to get the job done, and that's to persuade people to support their agenda.
Did they do that in a particular way? Like, did they have a different strategy?
No, I don't.
Like the water, they had watering holes.
What?
They had the watering holes, right? The hospitality rooms?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we had one, the railroads had one, too.
Sure.
We were on the fourth floor in the old Placer Hotel, and the Anaconda was on the sixth floor.
Yeah.
And, lots of organizations had lobbyist rooms there.
Yeah.
And entertained legislators if they came after the session was over. And we took a lot of them to dinner from time to time. Never thought it was really seriously wrong to do
that.
Yeah,
sure.
But it would be thought so today, surely.
Now, Jim, Wilkinson, I think, was the son of some important Anaconda Company official. I think he married into the Anaconda Company or something. Am I right about that?
I don't remember ever knowing that, if that's...
I'm not sure about that either. I know his son-in-law was Lloyd Crippen.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Maybe I'm thinking Lloyd married into...
Well, I knew Lloyd well, too.
Yeah. He's someone I think I'll be able to interview.
Sure.
Yeah, I think...
Where is he now?
He's in Butte, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, well, he says... A lot of knowledge, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think he does. You know, I remember that Wellington D. Rankin, kind of a colorful, large figure in the 1950s.
Oh, he really was, yeah.
Any thoughts or recollections about him? Was he? He was never a lobbyist, but he was an important political.
Oh, he was, yeah. He was a trial lawyer.
Yeah.
Very effective and capable one. I remember trying a case against him in Butte. And he did everything he could to irritate the other lawyers and to get their attention away from the point. And I remember I was making some argument, and Wellington stood up and he started jingling silver dollars in his pocket, and so the people started looking at Wellington and his antics. He was making a few physical motions as well, and I had to ask the judge to ask Mr. Rankin to quit making such a pretense of this of being a lawyer, that he was just acting as an agent against my presentation.
He was deliberately trying to distract the jury's attention.
He was. And the judge did call him down, too. Well, that was just the one of the many yeah. things he did.
He, I think, was, what was this now? I think his widow Louise may have told me that that Wellington Rankin had a kind of a running feud with the ACM, with the Anaconda Company.
Well,
and of course the Anaconda Company was the kind of the they owned the newspapers.
Oh,
they
yeah.
were kind of the dominating influence during
they
that
sure
period
were,
of time.
You bet. And if they had such a conflict, it wasn't apparent to most people. I don't remember that he was especially an antagonist to the company, as we called it. The company then was the Anaconda
yeah.
and the Montana Power Company together. They had a joint lobby. So the company is included
yeah.
both those.
Yeah. Huh. When I got to the legislature in 1971, the last hospitality room had closed down in 1969, the session before I got there. And the Anaconda Company had sold its newspapers in 1959. So I kind of missed out on this era that you're talking
yeah.
about. And so I don't know if the idea that the Anaconda Company controlled the legislature is overstated. I don't know. I mean, how would you characterize their influence, say, in the 1940s and 50s and 60s?
Well, I don't think it would be fair to say they controlled the legislature, but they had a very strong influence. And they did influence a lot of legislators to look kindly upon their positions, the company's positions.
How did they do it?
Well, just about being nice guys and getting people thinking that, gee, I like those people. They're not near as bad. The company's not near as bad as some of the very liberal Democrats.
Who would be, do you remember any individuals maybe that would have been especially in opposition to the Anaconda Company? Because you mentioned you didn't remember Rankin particularly being that way.
I don't remember that he was, no, but and I can't think offhand of individuals who would meet that definition.
Some populist kind of legislator or something or other back in the 50s or 60s?
Well, most of them, I think, were union leaders that I'm thinking about.
Okay.
Not so much, well, they were individual legislators too, of course, representing that viewpoint.
I'm trying to think of if I might be able to interview one or some, you know, that would represent a strongly different point of view, and there aren't too many left that would have a clear
record. Oh, I think so. I'll
We've talked about that a little bit before
yeah.
our interview. And I don't know, I remember there was a fellow named Dale McGarvey who was up in the Flathead Valley who was someone that I remembered.
Well, I don't think we should take time.
Okay.
I'm trying to dredge my memory right
okay.
now, but
okay.
when we get through, I'll talk a little
okay,
bit,
great.
See if I can think of something.
Super, great. Governor Bonner, any other thoughts on him or any reflections on him that you can remember, like maybe an anecdote, a story when you came in contact with him or anything like that that would kind of help?
Well, again, I was a lawyer, later partner in the law firm of Coleman, Jameson, and Lamy, and Jameson was the one that was defeated by Bonner in the Democrat
Party. Lamy was.
What?
Lamy was.
Lamy
yeah,
was.
Yeah,
yeah. Lamy. And he was a very fine lawyer and a man of integrity, too.
Yeah.
But
what you're saying is because you were Lamy's law partner, maybe it was a little more awkward for you to have known Bonner well.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
yeah.
How about Governor Aronson?
Oh, he was a fine man. An immigrant from
yeah.
Sweden, and he could hardly speak English to begin with, but he was a fine man, very honest, and he was bright but not educated very much.
Yeah. He had a he was had a clever wit, didn't he? Sometimes
he
I
did,
guess
yeah,
he was.
A sense of humor.
Did you ever meet with him at the governor's mansion, or know him socially, or?
Well, I do knew him socially. Yeah, I'm just trying to think. And I'm sure I was in the mansion. And might have had dinner there. Much I don't remember that though.
He had been a legislator, hadn't he, in the 40s and 50s, maybe before he was elected governor.
Right.
And then he was replaced, of course, by Governor Nutter.
Yes, and Nutter was a very good friend of mine. We used to go on hunting trips every fall. And he was a lawyer, too. So I knew him very well. I remember the tragic plane accident took his life.
How would you describe him?
Well, he was, I would say, rather blunt and honest and fair. And he was a tough-minded guy.
Yeah. Outspoken?
That's right, he was that.
And he and Tim Babcock teamed up to run for governor and lieutenant governor.
Yes, that's right.
Any knowledge of how that team might have been created or why?
Well, I don't know that it started out as a team intentionally. Tim Babcock, I think, had been a legislator from Miles City. And I don't remember much about why he decided to run for lieutenant governor, whether Nutter had anything to do with that or not.
Were there any big issues in the, there was an effort to maybe create public power in the state, something like they called them public utility districts or something like that?
Yeah, I don't remember much about that, but I think there was such an issue.
And the Democrats, I think, got on the wrong side of that issue in about the 1959 legislative session, and the Republicans won a big victory in 1960. I don't know if it was just on the basis of that or not. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I think that was one session, 59, in which I didn't have any part of the legislature. I had been a lobbyist in 45, 47 through 57, and then for a reason I can't recall, I didn't do any work with respect to the legislature in the 59 session. And then the next year, I ran for the House and was elected.
In 60?
Yeah. That was a time when we had, I think, 12 seats in Yellowstone County, and we all ran as a team. And so you didn't represent individual districts, you represent the county, which made it a lot easier because there wasn't any use to try to go house to house.
Sure.
But so we didn't do a lot of that particularly now. And
Republicans generally won most of the seats then too, didn't
they? Yes, we did then.
Yeah.
Some years we had all the seats, straight eight they called it. But there once in a while there'd be an individual Democrat too amongst the electees.
Let's see, I think Harold Gerke was one, and Willard Fraser, I think, maybe was one. Was he? I don't know, remember.
I don't think Willard was.
He was mayor, maybe that was it, yeah.
I don't think it was ever been that same.
I served with Harold Gerke, and I think he'd been elected a time or two before I got there. Are there any legislators that particularly stand out in your mind that you served with or that you lobbied?
Wesley Dewart was one. Dewart?
He became a congressman, right?
Became a congressman, yeah.
Why did he stand out in your mind?
Well, because he was an Easterner to begin with.
Yeah, spoke with a Massachusetts accent, and I visited with him briefly.
He did. And he was a very genteel man, and honest, capable and bright. Another one I remember was Zales Acton,
yes,
the United States Senator.
Yeah.
He had been in the legislature and the Senate too. And they both had been good friends of Bill Jameson, my mentor and later partner. Well, those are two that I remember well. But if I had a little more time, I could think about on the other side too.
Yeah. Any Democrats that stand out in your memory for whatever reason?
Well, yes, that's one of the things I was saying. I need to have a little more time to think about that.
Sure.
Trying to think of.
Do you remember Ori Armstrong?
Yeah, I knew him.
I knew him a little bit when I was a kid. I just have a kind of a little kid recollection. He wasn't a Democrat, of course, but he was a very prominent legislator from the Flathead County, when I was a little kid.
Ori Armstrong?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't remember him as a Democrat.
No, he wasn't. He was a Republican, but he's just somebody that I remembered from that era.
Oh, I thought you said he was.
No.
Well,
it was a guy named McDonald, I think, that was maybe the Speaker of the House as a Democrat back during that period of time. Maybe in. Of course, that might have been when you were gone, too, in 57 or 59. Ray Warrington?
Yeah. Eddie Dusoff.
Yeah, from Missoula.
Dusoff.
Yeah. I served with his daughter. Yeah, Eddie was a good public speaker, as I remember him. He was an attorney, I think, from Missoula.
I guess he was, too.
Yeah. Remember anything interesting about him or his role in the legislature or anything like that?
No, I never did know him very well, and I don't remember anything special about him. I'm trying to think of another Democrat who was from Lakeville, maybe from Missoula to begin with, but he was also up on the High Line for some time. Name didn't come to mind. I'm very forgetful these days.
How about lobbyists? You knew Ty Robinson, of course.
Oh, very well, yeah.
In my interviews with other people as a part of this project, Ty's name has come up more than once as someone who was a very gifted persuader and a very successful lobbyist.
Very good. And Jim Garlington, his partner.
Oh, Garlington also lobbied?
A little bit, but not much.
I see.
Ty was mostly. Yeah. And I remember another incident that brings to mind an old friend who was in the Senate, but a Democrat, and that's Geoff Sheehy.
Oh, yeah.
He was a lawyer here in Billings with Jack Schiltz, who was a Republican. But Skeff was an ardent Democrat. Butte to live to begin with, and he never got over that being from Butte. But he was in the Senate while I was sitting there. Ty was doing lobbying, and I remember one time somebody, for some reason, conceived that Ty had done something really egregiously wrong and dishonest. And Dick DeCivi, who was a Democrat from
Great Falls, Democrat Great Senator Falls, from Great Falls.
And I think he was maybe the Democrat leader of that session. Well, he got up and just raised hell about Ty. And then so did Skeff Sheehy. And I thought, shit, I can't believe that what they're saying is true. And so after we had a recess, I guess, I found out that it was absolutely not true. Somebody had misconstrued something that Ty had done. So, I guess maybe, I don't know whether it was on the floor or maybe before we resumed, we magazine. But I said, that's wrong, and you've got to apologize. Well, Dick DeSevier did apologize. He said, well, I'm certainly sorry I spoke so unkindly and unfairly about Ty Robinson. And I retracted and apologized. Skip wouldn't apologize. He would admit that he was wrong. That really irritated me. It's the only thing that I can remember adverse about Skip.
Yeah.
Except the fact he was on the wrong side.
Yeah. Very liberal Democrat, very charming. I've visited him.
Yeah, he is. And he's a good friend of mine.
Yeah. Wow. You know, of course, integrity is vital to the effectiveness of a lobbyist.
Sure is.
And I guess when I don't want to dwell on the hospitality rooms, but my impression is that they were used more for hospitality than lobbying.
Well, I think so. Yeah, that's right. They were. They didn't talk. Usually, didn't. And I had one of them too.
When you had one of them, what did you do? How did it work?
Well, we just greeted the guys that came in and give them a drink and some hors d'oeuvres, maybe, or beer or whatever.
This was at the Placer Hotel.
Yeah. And
what was it—a suite or a large room?
No, just a large corner room. The 21s were one or the other. The top floor was the sixth, and that's the anacondas. And then we would have adjacent rooms where, well, Jameson had one room and I on the other side had one. And so the anaconda people, there were more of them, and they had some other adjacent rooms to do. 621, the company room. I'm going to get a jacket.
Okay, good. Okay. Now, when you so the fellas would come in, the legislators would come in, and they'd sit down on a soft chair or something or other and have a cocktail and have an hors d'oeuvre, and they'd just shoot the bull about what happened that day, or
whatever they want to talk about, or the host wanted to talk about.
Sure.
Like friends and acquaintances sitting down and talking about whatever we want to talk about.
But it wouldn't generally be, if they came into the Railroad Association hospitality room, that you tried to bend their ear about railroad legislation or anything like that.
I don't think we did much of that.
Yeah. But I suppose if a guy came in and asked you a question about a bill,
sure. Yeah.
And the rooms were, there were several of them. I mean, the Anaconda Company had the biggest one, you mentioned, though, right?
Well, no. They had the biggest suite of adjacent rooms.
I see.
More of them to be housed.
So each lobbyist had his own room, and then they kind of open them up together for hospitality.
No, because this one corner room was not used for a dwelling.
Oh, I see.
But had comfortable chairs and maybe a sofa.
Yeah.
I don't think we had any beds.
So, you know, I guess my mind's eye was that they were larger than you're describing them. From how you described these hospitality rooms, there you probably couldn't get more than maybe 15, 20 people comfortably in them.
No, I suppose that'd
be about it. Yeah.
That was, let me see here.
You want to move in the living room? Okay. Okay, great.
I would think those 21 number rooms.
Where do you want to go? Right here?
Where do you want? I think think they would be about the size.
About the size of your living room here. Yeah. And then
might be a little bigger than they were.
And Al Wilkinson was the chief lobbyist for the Anaconda Company?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. And that would have been
now, the chief. There also Roy Glover.
Roy Glover.
And he was the chief counsel for the Anaconda.
I see.
You know, he was really the head, but he didn't do very much direct lobbying.
You know, a guy I met, Jim, later on, who I think may have had the same job Glover had for a while, was Bill Kirkpatrick.
Yeah.
You remember him, too?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, I remember him. I think he was a little later than Al started.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember he was a good fellow, too. All of those fellows were very pleasant.
Yeah.
And I think not more dishonest than most people.
You mentioned that they were really nice guys,
yes.
And that was a part of their lobbying technique and that sort of thing, to try
right.
to charm people and make them feel comfortable and that sort of thing.
Yeah, right.
And certainly they didn't just lobby Republicans, they lobbied Democrats and Republicans.
Surely they did.
Sure, yeah. And you didn't perceive any greater closeness between the Anaconda and Montana Power Companies and the Republicans than between them and the Democrats?
I don't quite understand.
Well, I think when I grew up as a kid, there seemed to be a perception that the company, so-called, was close to the Republican Party and the Democrats were independent of the company, so-called. And I think your perception is different than that. Your perception is that the Republicans were more independent of the so-called company.
Well, I think so. Well, I wouldn't say independent of them, but the two companies really operated together, the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda. And there were more Republicans, I think, in the power company organization. The upper echelon, then was probably true of the Anaconda, but we didn't perceive of them as being either Republican or Democrat.
I see. And Democrats probably wouldn't have perceived them particularly one way or another either.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Did the railroad, did you and Bill Jamieson, did you guys then work with other business lobbyists? I mean, like, did you work with the timber industry people and the mining industry people and so on, or were you, did you try to be as independent as you could be?
Well, I think we were generally quite independent, but I'm sure there were issues with which all of the business organizations were unified in.
Taxation issues, perhaps?
Sure. Well, I can't think of any particular ones, but I'm sure there were legislative things that were anti-business and some pro-business.
Yeah.
So we might have been unified in those for or against.
Would you describe the legislative sessions in which you served as, well, maybe I could ask you this way. It seems like there's a high level of partisanship in the legislature now. There's a lot of real battling between the Democrats and the Republicans, and I get the impression that that might not have been so much the case back in the 50s and 60s.
Well, I think that's, you're right about that, perhaps. There was certainly a lot of partisanship, all right, but I don't think it was carried to the extent, to the extremes that perhaps is present today.
Any thoughts on why that might be the case? Did the hospitality rooms help to bring people together in a non-political sort of way?
I think in a way, yeah.
Did the fact that there weren't term limitations then maybe make it possible for longer friendships to form? Maybe
surely.
That might have been.
And for legislators to pick become more experienced too.
Yeah.
Going, how to think, get things done and what's important, how to do it.
Tim Babcock. What are your thoughts on Tim?
Oh, he was a good friend and very likable guy. I think he'd been in the trucks business. So he's not a particularly well-educated guy, but he was bright enough and very pleasant, friendly, affable.
And of course, he became governor upon the death of Governor Nutter. Do you ever remember like meeting with him personally or anything like that?
Oh yes, many times I'm sure. I met many times with Nutter.
Yeah. You said you were a hunting friend with Nutter.
Yeah.
Now was Nutter a part of your SASH group?
He was.
And tell me what SASH stands for.
Well, it's an acronym for. I guess I devised this acronym. Select Assembly of Statesmen and Huntsmen. This is a joke, you know, but that's got to be known as SASH.
When did it begin?
I think it began in about early 50s, and it really came about through the urging of an old legislator from down in broadest country named Charlie Schofield.
Okay. I've heard of him.
He was a wonderful legislator and he was a rancher down there really in the early days. And highly respected and liked by Democrats and Republicans alike. Well, some of us got to be good friends of his and he kept thinking and saying, you know, we ought to get together and go hunting, have a hunting outfit. Turned out that one of the senators was Don Valentin, who came from Deer Lodge. And he had a cabin and some property up near the little town of Ovando. So one time he invited us, I guess, when Charlie was insisting we ought to get together. Well, we'll go off to my place. We did. And we went up there every year for many years. We had a kind of a revival session up at our cabin above Red Lodge not very many years ago, two or three. The ones who were left, but most of them long since passed away.
And so you just, Charlie Schofield and yourself and Don Valentin and two or three others would invite a friend or two in addition each year until,
right.
How big did the group get?
Oh, I think we might have had 15 or so at one time. I don't think I ever got bigger than that.
And you, you'd do a painting, wouldn't you? Of each one of the rendezvous? Didn't you do a... some artwork, or?
I did a lot of painting up there, all right, and I think that many of them are now in the museum in Orlando, which is B&B, I guess, next door to B&B. It was a Trixie's Saloon.
Yeah,
to begin with.
Yeah.
But it's now a museum, and there are quite a few of those paintings.
And so you just sit down with your talent as an artist, and you just paint a picture of the guy sitting around the table, or?
No, I think a lot of individual drawings.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But I also did a lot of paintings in the vicinity.
Yeah. Oh, of landscapes and things.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh my. He's taking a chance. Were there just Republicans in the group?
We might have had a Democrat, a conservative one. I can't think offhand about that.
And SASH, does it exist any longer?
Well, not really, no.
Yeah. But it must have lasted for close to 50 years. Huh?
It did until Don Belton died. And he has a son that lives up there. But he decided it wasn't the same.
Yeah. So I remember Don. I didn't serve in the Senate with him, but I think President Eisenhower appointed him postmaster or something in the Deer Lodge area. And when I first knew him, he had some, he was a deputy sergeant at arms or something like that in the Senate.
Might have been, yeah.
A couple of sessions maybe in the late 70s, early 80s, yeah. And I knew him a little bit then. And of course, he was a great friend of Gene Turnage's.
Sure he was.
Do you remember, now it was common, I think, and maybe it had something to do again with the camaraderie in the legislature that maybe existed to a greater extent in the 50s and 60s than did now, that there used to be mock sessions that sometimes the lobbyists would put on a mock legislative session. Do you remember about those at all?
Not very much, no. I never was greatly impressed with them.
I guess lobbyists would act the parts of legislators and try to reenact funny things that happened.
Lobbyists, mostly employees.
Oh, I see, staff. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else that you can think of that was an interesting part of your experience as a legislator or a lobbyist? Anything that comes to your mind?
Well, I was going to tell you about one session in which I think Alex Blewitt was the Republican leader, and I was his right-hand man, and I had an idea that the tax system ought to be renovated, changed, the property taxes. And so I was appointed the chairman of a special committee on classification and reassessment. And we had all the lawyers in the House on that, and a few others that had some experience. And we really worked like dogs. We'd start at 7 o'clock in the morning, and after the session we'd meet and we'd go up sometimes till 1 o'clock in the morning. And this went on for night after night. And we got some expert from the legislature in California to come and explain the system that they were using. As a result of those long, arduous hours of work, we put together a package of, I think, maybe 10 or 11 bills, entirely revising the property tax system, and passed in the House by about 4-1, and was transmitted to the Senate, and the chairman of the equivalent taxation committee in the Senate was John Melcher, bigger congressman, and so we presented to them bills to them. Well, they were referred to that committee. And without any discussion, without hearing us or anybody else, they killed them right there. Dead. I was just furious because we had just worked like dogs for so long. But the Democrats had charge of the Senate, and Melcher didn't like to even think about it, so to hell. Republicans. We had both Republicans and Democrats on that committee in this House. They wouldn't pay any attention to it. That was a very bitter pill for me.
Was there some philosophical problem in the bills that the Democrats would have?
I don't think so.
What were you trying to accomplish?
Well, a revision of an assortment of ills that had grown up in over 50 years, period, and try to make some sense out of the property tax system. Still needed some revival, some
sure. But I'm trying to think of why the Democrats would have a problem with that.
Well, because it came from a Republican House.
Just as simple as that.
Because
that sounds like a high level of partisanship, doesn't it?
Oh, it was violent right then.
That would have been, I'm thinking, maybe 1963 or 65?
63.
So Hazel Baker would have been Speaker?
I think he was.
Yeah.
Now, I've got that the House Journal home. You want to talk to me more about that?
Yeah, I'm interested in that. In fact, didn't Jim Felt carry through with some similar kind of an idea for reforming the tax system?
Well, he and I was as much responsible to begin with as Jim.
Jim Felt was Speaker of the House in like 67, maybe?
No, I'm thinking Jim Felt, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm thinking about Jim Lucas.
Yeah.
We both were very strong advocates of the sales tax. And I have a clipping from the Great Falls paper. Got a picture of me on the front page, a four-column picture, saying, profit of the sales tax. But Jim Lucas really got credit for it because when he ran for governor, that was a big issue, and it's what caused his defeat.
Yeah. Sure, Jim actually ran for governor, but I think Jim did never actually run for governor, I don't think, but I think our feeling was that he would have been defeated because of the sales tax.
Well, I was thinking he was a candidate, but maybe he wasn't.
Yeah, I think that because I served in the House of Representatives in 71 when he was Speaker, and we had a big impasse over the sales tax in the 71 session, and I think the assumption was Jim would probably run for governor in 72, and he didn't. Ed Smith did instead. So I think it was kind of the common perception was, though, that Jim Lucas would have been governor were it not for the sales tax.
I think that's true. But I guess I'm mistaken about thinking he'd run for governor.
And I think I know the answer to this, but maybe you could talk a little bit about your thoughts on why a sales tax would have been better for Montana. Maybe some thoughts on why there was opposition to it.
Well, the opposition, I think, was based on the antipathy of the labor union to it. And so the Democrats were largely, I think, supportive of the unions. The Republicans were not. And I think that we conceived that there was such a dependence on the income tax and the property tax that it needed to be spread out more, and we needed to collect money from those visitors that come here, and that it might be a better balance if we had three legs to the stool instead of two. Well, that's part of thinking that.
And what was the other side? What would have been the basis for their opposition? What did they argue?
Well, they argue that it hurts the common man. But I think in our bill we were going to exempt groceries and other necessities.
It turned out to be a good issue for the Democrats against the Republicans anyway.
It sure did.
Any other important issues when you were a legislator?
Well, I'm sure there were.
I mean, that you were involved in, importantly, that you'd like to talk about.
Well, not that I can think of offhand. If I were to give some thought to that, I could think of some things.
How about, like, back in the 50s when you were a lobbyist, were there major pieces of legislation that pertained to the railroad industry? Or
Well, yes, there were. Bills that
farmers concerned about freight rates? Would that have been a...
I don't think so.
Were there bills that pertained to, like, railroad brotherhoods, railroad labor unions?
Yes, there were, and that's, well, some of the opposition to some bills or support for them was based on the position of the railroad brotherhood. But immediately, I can't put my finger on it.
You mentioned Boo McGilvera a while back. I met him when he was a member of the State Historical Society.
Yeah.
And he was a storyteller. Yeah, I sat down and visited with him for a while in the cloakroom in the Senate, and he was a gifted storyteller and that sort of thing. Do you remember much more about him as a lobbyist? Or?
Well, no, I don't. As you say, he was a very likable person and good storyteller, and he had a lot of stories about the old days up in the Highland, cowboy types. But well, I don't know, he was subsidiary to Wilkinson, and he was kind of a left-hand supporter.
I remember once there was a fellow by the name of Arch Allen, who I think was a legislator for just one session.
Hammond?
No, Allen. The first name was Arch. Might have been Archibald. But he went by Arch, and his last name was Allen, I think, A-L-L-E-N. And he represented Park County for one session in the House of Representatives, perhaps in the late 50s or early 60s. And he had a tragedy in his family. There was some terrible medical problem that involved his wife or his mother or something. He had to leave the state about the middle of the legislative session. And so he, I don't think he resigned from the legislature, but what he told me he did, he said, I knew I was going to be gone for a long time, so he said I signed a stack of pear slips. You remember the pear slips we used to use when you couldn't be there? You'd pair your vote with someone else, and they'd agree not to vote. And he said, I left him with Boo McGilvera. And he said, Boo just voted me for the rest of the time I was gone during that legislative session. That struck me curious because Boo was a lobbyist, you know. And when I was a legislator, if you had to be away for a few days, you'd leave your pear slips with your floor leader. And he'd give you some notion of the bills he thought would be coming up. And he'd say, how do you think you'd want to go on this one? And you'd leave him some instructed pears. And then he'd say, now, if I'm really in a bind and I need to vote you, you know, will it be okay, just maybe sign three or four uninstructed pairs, just in case we need them, you know. And most of us usually did that. But I guess I was surprised when he told me he left those pear slips with Boo McGilvera, the lobbyist. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't remember anything about those pear slips. I think it might have come about after...
Could it?
I was...
Well?
In the Senate. I never remember signing one or getting...
Were you ever absent?
Well, yeah, I'm sure I was, but...
What we used to do is when you couldn't be there, then someone else, as a courtesy to you, would agree not to vote because you couldn't vote.
Well, so you didn't actually... I don't remember anything about that advice at all.
Well, huh.
Maybe it invented about... time I left there.
No, I think it was happening when you were there. The way it would work is that you just, usually they'd announce it on third readings. You could only use pairs on third readings. And they would just say something like 28 vote aye with Brown paired aye and 21 vote no with Smith paired no. And all that meant was that if Brown wasn't there, then our floor leader would go over across the Democrat floor leader and he'd say, you got anybody would pair with Bob Brown? Bob wants to vote yes on this. So somebody who was going to vote no on it would just sign the pair, and then he wouldn't vote because I couldn't vote.
Well, now let me get that.
I'll bet it's in the journal.
We'll see if it indicates it was used there.
Thank you. absent and not voting, and excused. No, I don't see any reference to pairs there. Huh? What session is that?
63.
63, huh? Well, I'll be darned. I don't know.
Well, at least they're not listed as
no,
such.
No, they're not listed as such. I sure see that. I thought I remembered, too, looking at the journal and seeing votes listed when they were paired. But you're sure right. I don't see any reference to them in here. I see one here where you were one of four guys who voted no. Hoy, Quallen, Selsted, and Smiley. Oscar Quallen, Tom Selsted, and Dick Smiley. You remember all of them, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Dick Smiley ran for Congress. Tom Selsted ran for Lieutenant Governor. Oscar Quallen, I think, just passed away a year or so ago.
Really?
He was minority leader, my second session in the House in 1973, yeah.
Very, very nice guy.
Nice guy. Just a prince of a nice guy. Great guy. Well, anything else comes to mind, Jim?
No. My memory is just terribly failing these days.
Well, I've sure enjoyed visiting with you. And,
well, I have too, Bob.
And it may be that other things will occur to you and we might be able to do this again.
Well, I'll try to give some thought. If I think of anything that seems worthwhile, I'll keep you called, but I don't think there's more than that.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.